you'll notice that a couple of these things are done on the orders list. And what that's led me to wonder is whether what we're seeing in Texas is the beginning of a different kind of shadow docket. We've used that term, or Pam coined that term years ago, to describe kind of routine cases that go through the per curiam process at the Texas Supreme Court, where they might not be that interesting or that divisive, and the court decides them without hearing oral argument. And they were called the shadow docket because they weren't set for argument. So you didn't have a clear indication that the court was interested in them, but they rolled along at a very slow pace, and they would be issued on a Friday orders list without anyone having really advanced notice, unless you were tracking along and seeing which kinds of cases were pending in that state and might have the court's attention. The same term, shadow docket, has been now used to describe a U.S. Supreme Court practice, which is what this Law Review article I've cut some out on the side is about, of hyper-accelerated cases going directly to the U.S. Supreme Court, usually brought by the Solicitor General, but sometimes by other government entities, that are trying to overturn district court decisions through procedural means on a hyper-expedited basis. And so you've probably been up too late on a Friday night sometime in the past few months and saw a news flash that the U.S. Supreme Court had just issued a decision in a religion case. Those are this kind of case. It just happens so fast. It's not the normal process. I don't know whether we're seeing something like that in Texas. We certainly have this situation with many decisions being issued off the regular schedule. And these cases are, in fact, usually brought by the government. I wondered if this was just COVID, if this is going to pass when the pandemic passes. But what struck me is that none of these cases were requests by the government to enforce health orders or to try to urge the court to step in to protect health. They were all questions about institutional power and roles, about which agency gets to decide or whether it's the governor who gets to override a local ordinance. So they didn't have a medical urgency. It's just an institutional question. And it also seems to me that these disputes over executive power are increasingly likely to recur. The one that was on my mind when I wrote this slide a few days ago was the governor's recent declaration of an emergency around the border, where he used that to order some licensing decisions about state facilities dealing with migrant children. This morning's Texas Tribune, if you pick up a copy of that, reminds us all that there's also an executive order about no money bail release that's still in place and that's still percolating around. And so I think we're in a political environment where there will be more of these decisions that are shifted to the executive, and it's going to lead to perhaps more of this kind of emergency type action being sought by government officials such as the Solicitor General. And I think it's an open question about whether what these emergency orders mean. Some of these had opinions attached, the stay orders did not. And I thought this was really striking in a very recent decision. The case that's linked here on the slide has a dissent and a majority who are disagreeing about, in effect, whether the court should try to follow one of its prior decisions in a stay action. If I tell you the case was named In Re State, that's not a very descriptive term during a pandemic. There are many times the state brought a mandamus. The court had some difficulty discussing the case too. You have both the dissent and the majority are referring to a stay order the court issued. They're hyperlinking to the place on the court's docket, and they just don't have anchors to cite to the court's reasoning. I think that the bigger question is whether these things are merely a practice that you would urge the court to be consistent with its past, or whether they're precedent. And we don't know. The court may struggle with that on its own, or it may start issuing opinions in these cases. Another thing we thought we knew that is different this year is that per curiams are unanimous. We've had at least two per curiams with separate opinions. Those are coded into my voting tables. That's not as unusual. That happens sometimes in election cases where the court majority wants to speak with an institutional voice. There are some very famous U.S. Supreme Court cases, including perhaps the most famous election case from the U.S. Supreme Court in which that happened. So turning to this question of court membership and voting patterns, and this is the kind of thing that sneaks up on you if you're not paying attention, but there's been a lot of turnover at the court. In the last several terms, there's been about one change per year. And we also have this week, again, announcement that a new change is about to happen with another retirement from the court. And this is a period of time with a significant amount of change. There was a period of time from 2003 to 2005 when six justices joined the court. Here we have five in just a few more years. This has been more orderly, but it's led to some difficulty in trying to get a handle on what's happening at the court in terms of voting. So I decided to take a step back and look at sort of a broader question about whether the justices are agreeing with each other more or less. And I looked to a statistic that had been developed for the U.S. Supreme Court by Professor Lee Epstein about sort of a total percentage in which the justices agree with the majority opinion. So across all the signed opinions of the case. And you can see this article came out in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's term where they only had eight justices. That's part of the context here. But it led to this unusual term for that court in which 89% of the time there was agreement on the judgment.